Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books Network and African Studies. I'm your host, Susan Thompson of Colgate University. My guest today is Riedel Kesselring of the Institute for Social Anthropology at the University of Basel in Switzerland. She's written a fascinating book titled Bodies of Truth, Law, Memory, and Emancipation in Post-Apartheid South Africa. It's published in 2017 by Stanford University. I found it to be an important book in my teaching and in my own writing, to understand the embodied and everyday effects of state-sponsored violence, as well as the limits of the law to produce social repair. Of particular interest is Kesselring's theorizing of the relationship between the body and the law as a mechanism to critique South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Reed, I found your book to be an innovative study of the TRC, its focus on embodiment and the ways in which formal justice institutions do not consider the everyday and present violence of injustice was particularly fascinating to me and to my students, if I'm honest. And for in my perspective, and one reason why I wanted to speak to you today is that your study illuminates the tension of people craving justice from institutions that simply aren't really designed to deliver it, leading the women you interviewed in Cape Town, South Africa, to file a legal suit in the United States. So my first question is, what brought you to South Africa to study the TRC? And of course, why Cape Town?
Thank you so much, Susan, for having me and for choosing my book to have a discussion about. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, what brought me to Cape Town? It's a while back, maybe 13 years. I was studying social anthropology at the University of Zurich at the time, and I went to study one term abroad at the University of Cape Town, which I did. But then I also wanted to stay on to do the field research for my master's thesis. And in the courses I took, I read a lot about the TRC, the Truth Commission, but also the criticism South Africans had. But there wasn't any piece which was very satisfying in terms of, showing me what happened since the Truth Commission. There was one book which I really like and still like a lot, which is Bearing Witness by Fiona Roth. And I went. She was in the same department, so I went to see her and ask her, what should I do research on? Is there any gap which you can identify, which I could be, could I be useful in doing some research in terms of the follow-up of the Truth Commission? As she did her study on the women and the TRC, but also the families of these women. So she said, there is a gap. Please look at what has happened since the Truth Commission. Are victims satisfied? What has happened since? And she connected me to a victims organization, Kulumani Support Group. And that was the beginning of a long engagement, which started with the master thesis, and then I continued to do my PhD in. So it was in a bit... It was a coincidence. I just, went to see her and ask, what do you need? But then things started to fall in place. I did that research for a master thesis, which wasn't a lot. It was a couple of months, and then I wrote it. But I also started to realize that the topic of apartheid victims actually had something to do with my being Swiss, coming from Switzerland, which we might talk about later, because Switzerland did have a role in sustaining apartheid. So the Swiss banks and the Swiss state. So in a way, I also got engaged politically with that question.
I think that's a really interesting answer. So I did, of course, the Swiss banks were there. I never really thought about that. You know, we have, I'm a Canadian, so of course we're always so self-congratulatory in how we don't participate, but that's just not true. We're socialized to believe it. But so, of course, you made relationships with women at the Kulamani organization. And like, who are they, and how did you understand their victimhood? Because I've always found in my own field work, the way that we researchers think and talk about people is quite different than how they think and talk about themselves. And I thought one value of your study was that you were really able to capture not only their lived experiences, but how the violence of the apartheid era was really embodied in their present day.
It was really a process, and it wasn't very easy. So that victims' organization Kulamani, they've had many researchers before me. So they had quite at least the executive office and the office bearers and the council. They had a clear idea of how to deal with researchers and didn't always have a good impression of them. So there was kind of a legacy of researchers flying in, getting some data, and flying out, basically. My advantage was that I really had time at my hands, especially for the PhD. I had about 2 years, at which I could just do anything, basically hanging around with the organization, but then also with individual members. And that probably, you know, was an advantage to actually get engaged with the women and men, but mainly women themselves. I didn't start, I didn't come to Cape Town and with the plan of doing research on the bodily experience of victimhood. It's really something which came to me as I proceeded in the research. So I wrote the proposal, everything you have to do as a PhD candidate, but it was quite a different proposal at the time. It was focused on the law and the legal discourse, etc. But only as time went by and after many months, even a year, I realized there's something which the law doesn't capture. It's easy to speak about legal discourse of victimhood and criticize how victims use it, or, you know, show how they use it. When do they frame themselves as victims? When do they say they are survivors? How do they position themselves? But it's quite a different story if you try to capture what it actually means to be physically and mentally and emotionally a victim. And that's a dimension which only dawned on me as I, you know, conducted my research. So the bodily dimension was kind of thrown at me by the people I did research with and on. Which I quite appreciated as a process, because it then became dialogical in a way.
Well, such an interesting part of your book, I think. So, of course, you have a 6 chapters that are substantive, plus the intro and conclusion. And you write at the end, the ethnographic experience and anthropological knowledge. And I appreciated that chapter because you show how your thinking evolved over time, not because you came as an all-knowing researcher, but because of your ability to, number one, listen, but to, number two, also appreciate the bodily reactions that these women were having. And, you know, maybe my knowledge is not complete, but I found that very few researchers engage the bodily dimension of doing research. I think what really stood out for me is your theorizing of embodiment, but also your attention to how to understand these women, you know, in their context and everything. And I think one thing we forget about as researchers is that the violence of the everyday doesn't end, even when the state, of course, projects itself as a victor. And the TRC, of course, is a great example. It's hailed as a model to be replicated by members of the international community. But if you go into the neighborhoods and flats of Cape Town, you see that the TRC is really a failure for them. So how do you manage as a researcher the promises? People, you come, you said your research terrain was quite crowded, you had time on your side. How do those relationships play out in the production of anthropological knowledge?
Again, it was a process in that I started working for the organization, which was, you know, just as a volunteer and as a researcher, just helping them with whatever they needed, the computer or designing a flyer or organizing something, which also showed my commitment, and I had something to do, which I was relieved about. Mm-hmm. And that was the kind of an entry point for me to also then meet individual members in their everyday lives, in their communities, and not at the office anymore, but actually where they lived. And that happened after a couple of months. So I would start to visit them on a daily basis, as often as I could, and just be with them at, especially when it comes to the experiences of, you know, the disappearance of children or the killing of their husbands or their own illnesses or injuries, which are often expressed as diabetes or high blood pressure or these chronic diseases. It's not something people want to talk about, especially not to anyone. And I was quite cautious not to re-traumatize them. So sometimes one of the women started to speak and told me something, but then she would break down, and I wasn't prepared for that, and I'm not trained as such. I'm not a psychologist or anyone who could, you know, really counsel them. So I became quite cautious and didn't even ask questions about their past. But rather just try to see how do they manage today? What are they doing in the morning? And how do they look after their grandchildren? Where do they meet? Where do they do their shopping? Where do they get their medicine? And what are their daily needs and concerns and struggles? So I kind of moved to the background and just tried to be. And that was probably the best move I made, in a way, to really come close to some of the women and have something which was as much as it can be equal, so they could also decide on the terms of, you know, engagement. Often they would tell me, I feel too sick, you shouldn't come today, or they would ask me to bring medicine which they couldn't get in their local pharmacy. Would also ask me for favors with some bureaucratic stuff.
I think, sorry.
That, exactly, yes, please.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I think one of the values of the book is this, the way you write poignantly about the relationships you made, and of course you're speaking about them, I can hear you becoming emotional, and that's one thing that I think researchers can be more mindful of is, we too have emotional relationships with our participants, and they become friends of a sort. And, you know, everything is sort of rooted in the relationships that we build. What relationships, if any, do you have with them today? Are you still in touch with them, or is it something maybe they didn't want, where you did write about victimhood? Sometimes we can be triggering.
I'm still in touch. And I left on a good note, and I kept on coming back. So after I did the biggest part of my research, I returned every year. I also returned when the book came out and gave a copy to each of them, and also to a couple of copies to the organization, and launched the book with them and discussed it with them. So I'm still in touch, and I think they feel represented, and maybe a little bit empowered. Somebody wrote a complete book on them. And it's an international book. It's internationally available.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's continuous. And I moved on in terms of research. I'm now doing research on Zambia, a different country, a different topic. But I'm still in touch with them. And I might go back to, you know, to do a follow-up.
Of course.
We call one another and I get updates. Many of them are elderly, so they are not very good at social media, or some of them even don't have a phone. So it's often, you know, I go through one person and we speak about the others and I get an update of how they are. And many of them pass away.
Of course.
As the years go by. So I learn about that as well.
I think that's one of the values of your book. If you've documented the lives of, you know, women in particular, but people we don't hear that much about. And I think that's really one of the values of your study. And that's my next question more substantively. Mm-hmm. What is the status of the legal case that is at the heart of your book?
So the cases were filed almost 17, 18 years ago in the US courts, and it went through all the different, you know, the district court level, appeals court, even Supreme Court. And eventually it was dismissed. So there's, it's finished. That's the short answer to a long legal story, quite a fascinating legal story. So it wasn't successful in that sense and quite disappointing. Maybe for those to the listeners who don't know it, it was a case submitted by apartheid victims. It was a class action eventually, and it was submitted against multinational companies which aided and abetted the apartheid regime, and especially the security forces. And one after the other, the companies were dropped by the courts because there was too little evidence or connection to the United States to have enough evidence of a violation. And the multinational companies weren't just American. They were mainly European. But they used the Alien Tort Statutes, which allows foreigners to sue companies which have at least a branch in the United States. But as the court case, you know, took its history, the usage of the Alien Tort Statute became narrower and narrower. So it became impossible for the claimant to prove the case, and the case was eventually dismissed.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, part of the story of your book, and I think it's such an important one, is the embodied reactions of being in an open setting, hearing from lawyers, trusting the knowledge of lawyers, but also being skeptical about this sort of formal knowledge, let's call it, or legal knowledge, and the way that the women you interviewed knew that the apartheid state had harmed them and that they continued to live with the pain that they experienced, you know, diabetes or high blood pressure, the things you mentioned a few minutes ago. Your book, of course, does a nice job of theorizing the relationship between the law and the body using embodiment theory. So what happened in the course of your research that you realized what was happening was actually an embodied reaction? And what can the embodiments, for lack of a better word, of these women tell us about the study of violence and the study of justice, or perhaps the impossibility of justice?
Maybe to start from elsewhere, as you mentioned, scholars, but also activists are often quite skeptical about the law, that, you know, making legal case would actually bring a solution to a case, an emotional or a solution to experiences of violence. And I share this skepticism.
Sure.
Because often if people as a group or individuals turn to the courts, they are quite disappointed. For one, often there's not even a decision, as in the apartheid cases I talked about a minute ago.
Yep.
But also as people start to get entangled in the courts and this logic of proving their case, they get harmed a second time, a third time, and also their experiences, which, as we say, are quite embodied, and they know that in a way they have the truth of a violation in their bodies, becomes stripped and what remains is a very legalistic perspective on the violation, which is very far away from what the claimants actually want to say. But at the same time, the law, so scholars and activists will say it's not only this, what they call legalization happening, something becomes legal even though it's political.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually even more, an issue becomes depoliticized. As you turn to the courts, things get almost swallowed by the legal logic, and politics doesn't play into it anymore. So these questions, which are inherently political, you know, who is in charge of a transformation, who should be redressed and receive reparations, etc., become legalized and therefore politicized. So while I share these concerns, and I think we've seen that in the cases I looked at as well, I also think that the law has at least the potential to help people to emancipate from their experiences. And I was interested in that tiny possibility, so to say, and I tried to see how can we understand that in terms of apartheid violations. So how I theorized that the relationship between the law and the body was to say, yes, the law is very discursive. It's very limited. And everything which is beyond the law the other way around, people can only start to claim their rights or redress or reparations if they have gone through a certain experience, like a violation.
Right.
So they connect much, much more than people usually think to a court case. They connect their whole subjectivity to that legal possibility of maybe transforming their personhood.
Well, it's so interesting in the South African case. Thank you for your answer there. And I put you on the spot a little bit. Because one thing that I think really comes to the fore in your book are the intersecting bodily experiences of class, but also of race. Mm-hmm. And of course, age. You mentioned earlier that many of the women in particular you spoke to are elderly, quote unquote. How does class and race and age continue to play out for the women in your study?
That's a very good question. I never framed, you know, the topic in these terms, but of course these three notions are all over. And it's quite, that makes it comparable, I guess, to the United States and other places. So age, is very important in the sense that it's quite a generational issue. The women I worked with, and maybe the next generation, they have direct experiences of what it was, what it felt like to live under apartheid. So they lived through it, and then you know, saw the advent of democracy. But for them, they still feel the legacy of apartheid in, on an everyday basis. But then a younger generation, which wasn't maybe was born after 94 or even a bit earlier, for them, the issue is quite different. And I think we see that now with the student protests in South Africa.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years, they are much more impatient with transformation, but they're also much more, they have much more energy, so to say, to claim their rights for transformation from a very different position. So sometimes there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect between the generation I worked with,
sure,
and the newer generation, which I often found a pity that they don't communicate more with one another, because they would have a lot to say to one another. And it's probably something which we also saw in Germany after, you know, World War II, and how a new, younger generation in 68 had enough of their parents' silence, so to say, and was much more radical and loud. But in the essence, they spoke of the same, you know, issue. So there's definitely an age gap or yep. issue here. Class, of course. So I could have written about Nelson Mandela and other few individuals who made it, who could step up social classes, so to say.
Right.
And could participate in the new South Africa. But in the end, there's just a handful of people, or some, you know, new middle class, some people say. But I quite doubt how many there actually are. Many of them live in debt and quite precariously so. So they probably fall back into a working or a lower class quite easily. And my research was really with lower class in terms of their socioeconomic background and the means they had to emancipate themselves through a job or a new education or something which would help them to step up the social ladder. So class in that sense is very important, even though it's not used anymore in South Africa as a political, analytical lens.
Right.
But it probably should.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just the last one, race. Well, the whole apartheid system was built on an idea of race and races. That's probably quite a self-explanatory point. Most victims are black South Africans or from neighboring countries, those who, you know, participated in labor migration. But there are also, of course, whites and victims, and they're also quite vocal and have a similar story to tell. But essentially, it's still a race issue.
Well, it's so interesting, your comment about the Fees Must Fall protests, the tuition protests at the University of Cape Town, and of course, other universities in South Africa, really does show, I think, and your book does a nice job of picking this up, that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is an embodied reality for South Africans who lived through it, and it's a normative or an ideal for those who've not. But the protests really show the limits of the TRC in some way, and of course, mm-hmm. South African society more broadly, to manage the pain and the harms and the violence of that time. So I think one thing your book does well, and this is my next question, is you recognize that the TRC not only failed to adequately incorporate bodily forms of victimhood, but that it really didn't do anything to push actual truth and actual reconciliation in South Africa. So the question is, how can studies of bodily victimhood tell us or teach us about the limits of the transitional justice project?
Maybe first to clarify, I still admire the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa, and it's been copied all over the world. I don't think it could have done much, much more than it did with the mandate it had and the funds it had and the quite precarious political times it worked in. So the main issue is probably for myself, but this is something which came up in conversations with my research interlocutors. It wasn't so much the TRC which failed, but that there was very little follow-up of the TRC. So the TRC made quite expansive recommendations and on a whole range of things, as you know,
yes,
starting from symbolic reparations, but also to uplifting people with financial redress or possibilities of getting an education. But very little of these recommendations were actually taken up by the South African state under Mbeki administration at the time.
Right.
And later, Zuma and up to today. So it's not so much the failure of a institution, which would also maybe be too much to have asked, but what happened since. And in that sense, it's something which we can learn from apartheid victims who say, basically put the issue on a flag saying there is a legacy and the legacy of our experiences needs to be dealt with. You can't just have an institution which runs for 1 or 2 years, which relies on language and people being able to speak and then everything should be fine. You need to follow up and there's need to have continuous healing in that sense, which should engage victims and include them in this process.
And I appreciate your comment, as of course you probably know the Canadian government is engaged in a TRC-type activity with Indigenous communities, and they are taking, just as you described in South Africa, a one-and-done kind of approach. We talked about this. Let's move on. We have bigger issues. But of course, as your book, I think, shows quite well and quite tragically, actually, you know, service delivery is an issue. Access to education and health remains an issue. Some of these structural issues that, you know, shaped their lives pre-apartheid, never mind the violence of the apartheid era, continues to shape their lives today. So I appreciate your comment on follow-up. And of course, I think that's what's so fascinating about your book and why I wanted to interview you today, because of your theorizing of the embodiment and the embodiment of violence. It really comes into thinking about lives live after violence. And that's something that, of course, scholars have thought about, but policymakers less so. So that's one question I have for you. If you had an audience with a South African political leader or someone who could actually perhaps do something, what advice would you give them?
Before I would even dare to give an advice, because I think they have quite a difficult job.
True.
I would maybe try to sensitize them on the fact that very few things in our lives, very general, are easily put into words. So most of the experiences and most of what we do is bodily. We walk without explaining to somebody how we walk. And it's only if we stumble, we realize, oh, we've been walking, you know, without any problems. How do I actually do that walking? And we would struggle to explain how walking works. It's something we just naturally do, and we have learned, so we do it habitually. And even more so with experiences which were harmful, it's very difficult to put that into words, especially if it has shaped our lives to the extent that it directs our movements or how we engage with people from another social class. So what I want to say is that apartheid victims and victims more generally of any kind of violence struggle to put their experiences into words. You know, what I mentioned with the law a couple of minutes ago. So they struggle to do the same with politics. Let's say they're invited by a minister and says, okay, I listen to you now. Tell me everything, you know, you want to tell me. people would probably struggle to exactly formulate what they know, even though they live it every day. So the first advice would probably be that we become scholars, but also policymakers, become more aware of the things which are difficult to pronounce, and that we learn to listen better, especially in a post-violent society where even the minister or policymakers themselves have gone through these experiences. So it's sometimes a bit surprising how little they listen to victims, even though they actually share some of the experiences, even those who were in exile. So, and the second dimension is coming from Switzerland, but also, having a more international perspective, that we shouldn't forget that South Africa really didn't have funds in the 90s
mm-hmm.
to redress 90% of the population, to put it simple, and
right.
to roll out massive programs for socio-economic upliftment of the majority of its people, because the international community, they contributed something to the upliftment of the country. But most debts, which were odious and illicit, according to some lawyers,
right.
South Africa actually repaid. So there was very little to start that new South Africa on, materially and financially. So the advice I would give maybe to South Africans and at the policy level is to start claiming some of the funds from the international community, from the different countries, from the businesses, the banks, the automation and IT industry, which all profited from apartheid.
Sure.
At the time. And that's something which has never happened. And that's what the apartheid cases we talked about actually tried to get.
I think that's one thing that is really eloquently elucidated in your book, is the difficulty of speaking violence in a way that politics or law can actually understand and appreciate. And of course, that's a stumbling block to reparations or repair, never mind sort of the structural inability of, funding and mandates and precarious political climates. And that raises a question I had about practical concerns. How do you manage as an anthropologist, how do you talk to your students about the work that you do and how you study the lives of people who have lived through violence? It can be very easy to exoticize an other, and of course you're very careful not to do this in your study. What kind of advice would you give to a new anthropologist, perhaps picking up on your study and continuing the work in South Africa?
I would probably ask them or advise them not to do interviews. This is something which even at our department in a methodology course, the first thing would be, we teach them how to do interviews,
yes,
or do conversations, just because this is something you can transcribe, and in the end you have something black and white and you have real data. And everything else which is not a conversation is a bit scary, because the students think, and even PhD students and scholars think, these are not real data.
Right.
But I had lots of data on the bodily dimension of victimhood in my field notes. That's, our way of documenting our research as we go along. Every evening we write our field notes. It was just not there black and white. It was between the lines, in a way. Again, even for myself, it was difficult to put it into words. So I had to develop some kind of a language for myself, and then for the book, to speak to an audience. There was another struggle in and another translation in a way. So to the students, I would say, engage with people as much as you can, but talk as little as you can. And
listen.
Try to learn from others, not just what they say, but also how it feels to be with them and what you sense as you spend time with them. We are quite receptive if we stop talking for a moment. I think everyone is. We just often talk too much because we are nervous and we think, you know, we should keep the conversation going.
That's a good point, yeah. Americans in particular, I think, are guilty of this. Many of us are, but...
And also, speaking of a PhD project, you have questions in your mind which you want to have answers. And you come prepared, you know, as a good PhD student or scholar.
Of course.
And instead of first listening, what are the issues in the location where you landed for some reason, we often talk too much. But should be the other way around. We should be able and free, also freed by funding organizations, to do research bottom up, just to be able to not say too much and to listen. So the context tells us what the issues are and what we should write about. So it's a mandate in a way.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. And of course, we've already taken up, Rita, quite a bit of your time. So I want to start to close by asking you two final questions. Do you have any books or articles or things listeners who are keen to learn more about your work could read? And of course, is there anything that you wanted to say that I didn't ask you?
For articles and books, especially the body, it's quite difficult to write about and to find a language, as I mentioned. So to students and scholars, my advice would be, at least what I do, is I go back to classics, you know, like Bourdieu, and even sometimes philosophy, although that could be tricky, Merleau-Ponty, and Marcel Mauss, again, another classic in terms of what is a habitus, what is a body, and what do we know bodily. So I find that quite refreshing to go back to these early writings. And to find a language of a close description of people's lives, I often just read not scholarly stuff, but just great books.
Mm-hmm.
So that would also be an advice. Even detective stories or something, they know how to write. And I think we can learn a lot from them. But in terms of the topic of apartheid victims, or that story, I would maybe recommend to read a book which just came out. It's called Class Action in Pursuit of a Larger Life by Charles Abraham. It came out with Penguin Press. He is one of the lawyers, the South African lawyers, which was at the beginning of the apartheid litigation. So he writes the whole story from a lawyer's perspective. And what's more, he grew up in the Cape Flats, so in a very poor community, and worked his way up to becoming one of the most best-known lawyers in South Africa and even internationally in the United States. So I would advise students or anyone else interested in the topic to read that. If you are more interested in international connections of, you know, who financed apartheid and what's the legacy of it. And as an example, maybe look at Switzerland. There is a report which was published by Georg Kreis. I can give you the details.
Yes, thanks.
And it looks at the relationship, the business and bank relationship, but also between the two governments between 1948 and 1994. That's a nice report if people really want to get into the details of these very dubious relationships. And maybe finally the book I mentioned, which inspired me initially, Bearing Witness by Fiona Ross, is also a really great book on the topic, which kind of preceded my study. So these two books can be read together.
Well, it's so interesting that you mentioned Fiona Ross, because, of course, you know, most of my work is on Rwanda. Her book, Bearing Witness, also inspired me to do the work that I did in a different context. Mm-hmm. So it's a really important book, yeah, to me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and then last but not least, is there anything that you wanted to share with listeners that I failed to ask you? So, of course, my questions were really about my area of interest, and we didn't talk so much about the law or anything that I failed to ask you that you want people to know?
Maybe a concern which is also in the book, but I still struggle with, and I think as a scholarly community, we should keep on working on the topic, which is solidarity, in the sense that, you know, I talked about the class actions and how people institute cases as a class or as a group of thousands, even 10,000s of victims. And it's always a thin line of a solidarity being established through court cases, because it's a class, so everyone is the same. You become a group.
Mm-hmm.
But also, as soon as there is the possibility of a payout, of redress, financial redress, this is always a threat of the solidarity breaking apart. And that's a tension which I really try to get my grip on, and I still struggle with politically also, because it's a national, regional issue, but it's also an international issue. How can we show solidarity?
Right.
And, you know, as scholars from elsewhere, and work together and be wary that that our struggle can easily be broken apart by financial,
like relationships.
Exactly. Or an inequality between Europe, United States, and African countries. So solidarity is just something I would want people to write and think about.
Yeah, thank you for that, Rita. I want to thank you for a great interview. Everyone should read your book, Bodies of Truth, Law, Memory, and Emancipation in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.